This podcast of NPR's On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Self-made billionaire Mark Cuban drives referees nuts. The super-rich, mega-manic owner of the Dallas Mavericks is famed and infamous for his courtside rants in the full lather of NBA basketball, and he's got the million-dollar fines to prove it. But now, Mark Cuban, entrepreneur and tech visionary, is shaking up the much bigger world of American media, and first of all, Hollywood. He's pushing his mind and megabucks into movies that come out the same day in cinemas and on DVD, like the new film, Bubble, into high-definition television everywhere, into a multi-tiered internet. Hollywood hates it. He couldn't care less. Up next on Point, media mogul, media maverick, Mark Cuban. Joining me now from Dallas is Mark Cuban. He's owner of the Dallas Mavericks, founder of Broadcast.com, which he sold to Yahoo in 1999. He created and co-owns with partner Todd Wagner 2929 Entertainment, an umbrella company that holds a digital movie production house, a distribution company, a theater chain, Landmark Theaters, and two high-definition television networks, HDNet and HDNet Movies. Mark Cuban, thanks very much for being with us.
My pleasure, Tom, and I appreciate the introduction.
Mark Cuban, what are you trying to do here?
I'm trying to just be smart and, you know, create great movies and put those movies in a position to be seen by the greatest number of people and in an environment that hopefully is economically self-sustaining.
Hollywood says, you're going to kill us, Mark Cuban. You're killing us right now. How can you release movies in this way without busting up the whole system that has been bringing home the bacon for decades?
They said the same thing about the VCR. Remember the comparison by Jack Valenti to the Boston Strangler? There was a period in time when Disney and Viacom said they would never, ever release movies on DVD because of the threat of digital piracy, yet that's gone on to become our largest source of revenue. So, you know, Hollywood doesn't have a great track record in terms of threats to the industry. In fact, usually when they say something is a threat, it's usually the best thing that ever happened to the industry.
So is it working? You put Bubble out. How's it doing? You put it in the theaters. You put it on DVD the very same day. Is this working? Is your experiment panning out or not?
Well, given that most movies lose money and Bubble has been out less than 2 weeks and it's already profitable, I'd say it's working.
But I'm looking here at numbers. Has grossed $72,000 from 32 theaters, most owned by you and Todd Wagner. That doesn't sound like
sure.
a big number. That sounds
no, of course it's
like
not a big
flop.
Number. Well, I wouldn't call it a flop because there's a lot of independent movies that are released, not to a great number of theaters, not to a lot of fanfare, not with a lot of high box office expectations. But traditionally, when those movies are released, typically independent and art house fare, they go on beyond their box office to sell maybe a couple thousand copies of the DVD. You know, we've done, instead of the 10 to 25,000 range, we've done four times that amount and growing. So being able to take advantage of the freshness of the movie, the interest in the movie around its box office release, we've been able to sell a whole lot of DVDs and become profitable, and that in turn allows us to do more of those.
But you know the traditional Hollywood pattern, and we're going to hear later in this hour from John Fithian at the National Association of Theater Owners. You, Mark Cuban, are driving them nuts. The traditional pattern was you tightly control the sort of chapters of release, the release windows or frames, I forget what they call it.
Right, the windows.
The windows. And that is, it goes to the theater first, you charge a lot to get in there with your popcorn and sit in the theater, and you milk that until that starts to run out, then you come on with the DVD, and then ultimately, you know, to the hoi polloi on television. You're breaking that up. How's this going to work?
It's going to work very well. I mean, the music industry tried to retain control of their traditional windowing as well, and we saw what happened. You know, we're past the age of analog and digital convergence. We're in a purely digital era, and people have a completely different set of expectations in how they consume their entertainment, whether it's on a portable media device, whether it's through their personal computer, whether it's through their television on a high-definition screen or analog screen, or whether it's in the movie theater. And the music industry faced a similar scenario, and they basically tried to insulate themselves and build moats and walled gardens around themselves, and it failed miserably. And I think if Hollywood tries to do the same thing, they'll fail just as miserably, which in all candor, you know, if someone's going to go out and make bad business decisions, and that just creates more opportunity for entrepreneurs like myself and Todd and other innovative filmmakers.
You're seen as a bomb thrower. It was funny. We read in Fast Company magazine, they say, almost with astonishment, he's actually mild-mannered and rational in person. Not what we expected.
When people see me on the sidelines at a Mavs game, I think people tend to use that as a broad brush on me in particular. But, you know, the way I am when it comes to playing or watching basketball, that doesn't serve me real well when it comes to business.
Well, a broad brush with a point on it. I mean, you got charged a fine, a record $500,000 for saying one ref was not fit to manage a Dairy Queen. Next thing we knew, you were working in a Dairy Queen for the day yourself.
Well, you can't take yourself too seriously, right?
You can't, but we kind of want to understand this maverick spirit that is now moving in on Hollywood. Give us your background in a nutshell, Mark. Where did you come from?
I grew up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Yeah. My dad and my uncle ran an upholstery shop, so that if you got a tear in your car seat, you would take it to my dad, and he'd sew it all up. Or if you got a rip in your convertible top, you'd take it to my dad and my uncle, and they'd fix it. And, you know, my dad was very clear to me that, you know, he didn't want me bent over ripping out seats in a car. He wanted me to find some intellectual pursuits. And he got me involved in business at an early age. I remember being 12 years old and wanting to buy some things and going to my dad and him saying, you know what, if you want something, you've got to go out and earn it and be innovative and come up with ideas to earn money. And I'm like, Dad, I'm 12 years old. And one of his buddies tossed out, why don't you go sell garbage bags door to door? I've got access to garbage bags.
Yeah.
And that's where I started my business career, and I kind of went from there.
Selling garbage bags, and pretty soon you've
got... Door to door as a 12-year-old,
yep. 12-year-old. You got in the computer business, 1995, broadcast.com. You started in 95. It sold to Yahoo for $5.7 billion, 1999. What was broadcast.com?
Broadcast.com was actually my second or third technology venture, but what Broadcast.com was in 95, Todd Wagner and I basically were sitting around just discussing different ideas, mm-hmm. and he came up with the idea. He said, we both went to Indiana University, we're both basketball fans,
yep.
and he was like, there must be a way we can use this newfangled internet thing to listen to sports over the net. You're the geek, you know, can you figure this out? And I went home and gave it some thought and did some research, and I had just set up my first web server and set up my first ISDN line. And as I did more research, I realized no one was doing this. The technology wasn't quite there yet, but it made perfect sense that it would be. So if we got started now, we'd have a head start. And, you know, the next thing you know, we started contacting sports teams, universities, radio stations. Mm. And, you know, we were working with PBS and a variety of different independent organizations like KERA here in Dallas. And we started streaming over the net, and it just took off.
Now, you did all right out of that. Forbes says you're worth about a couple billion bucks out of that. But how did Yahoo do? I mean, here's one test. Was broadcast.com a good buy for Yahoo? Your timing was certainly great. You sold on the eve of the bust. How did it work out for them?
Well, at the beginning, it started off great, and then when the internet stock market kind of cratered, everybody's stock, definitely cratered. When it got cut by 80%, everybody pulled back. And one of the casualties of what Yahoo was doing at that time was the streaming media applications that Broadcast.com had come in. Now, in hindsight, I know in talking to them, they wish they hadn't cut back on it, because the sweet spot right now of the internet is rich media or multimedia, you know, whether it's video on demand, whether it's streaming, whether it's, you know, peer-to-peer download of movies, TV shows to iTunes, whatever it may be. So as it turns out, it was the right acquisition, the wrong execution for Yahoo.
So here you are on the other side of that. You know, the thing, when people toss around a criticism, and never mind the referees, you know, they've got their own issues with you, Mark Cuban. The cinema owners have their issues. The kind of business mm-hmm. critique is, he's so rich, he can throw his money anywhere. It doesn't really have to be wise.
That's not the way I look at it. I mean, I don't think I ever throw money away. I'm not a real, people perceive me as a risk taker, but I'm really not. You know, I love what I do. It's something that, you know, my wife always says, well, why don't you take a vacation? And I tell her, if I took time off, I'd be reading technology magazines. I'd be online exploring different technologies and you know, looking at the business applications. And so doing things like starting HDNet and HDNet Movies in 2001, when everybody looked at a high-definition television and said, you know, no one's ever going to buy those things. They're too expensive. It's never going to be a big deal. It's never going to become mainstream. And, you know, here we are now. And by the end of 2006, people expect 26 million homes to have high-definition sets and programming, which is more than DVRs. So I tend to try to look at technology and look at the business opportunities that it creates. And in particularly in the media world, I think that the habit is to do things the way it's always been done. And the people who tend to make the decisions are either very bureaucratic and or not very familiar with technology. And that opens the door for a lot of opportunity for me. And I've just tried to walk through that door.
We're talking this hour with billionaire, media maverick, entrepreneur, owner of the Dallas Mavericks, worst nightmare of basketball referees, cinema owners, and old Hollywood Mark Cuban. You may have seen his movie Bubble. It came out on DVD and in the theaters on the same day. That's driving a lot of people in Hollywood crazy. I want to bring one of them in right now. Joining us from Washington is John Fithian. He is president of the National Association of Theater Owners. John Fithian, thanks for being with us. You say Mark Cuban's going to kill the business. What's your charge?
No, I don't exactly say that Mark Cuban's going to kill the business. Look, I have a lot of respect for Mark Cuban. He's a smart businessman. He's had some great ventures. But even smart business people can occasionally have a bad idea, and this idea of releasing movies everywhere at the same time is just a bad idea.
Why?
Well, the traditional model in Hollywood works, which is product is designed for different venues. Movies are made for television, movies are made for DVD, and movies are made for theaters, and they're different. Our patrons understand that when they go to a cinema, it's a different type of picture than they'll see on movie on the week. If you follow Mark's strategy and release pictures everywhere, all pictures will begin to become alike. You'll see a movie on the week at cinemas just like you see them at the home.
And so, therefore, the charm is gone, the magic's gone, the money's gone?
Absolutely. We don't want to do movie of the week. We want to do cinematic pictures with sizzle and flair. And we believe that this model will take away that special quality of our pictures. Consumers have choice now. Mark wants to help consumer choice by giving pictures everywhere at the same time, and we think that really decreases their choice by taking away the special value of the movies.
What do you say, Mark Cuban? John Fithian is quoted as talking about the suggestion as a death threat to the business. Right now you hear him saying it's going to flatten movies, make them into movie of the week. You're going to take away the grandeur. How about it?
Oh, I agree with a lot of what he says, but I give theater owners, and being a theater owner, I give us a lot more credit than he's giving them. I think as a theater owner, we are smart enough to select the movies that we want to go into our theater. So if a movie is movie of the week quality or doesn't have a special reason to be in a theater, we won't show it. And I think the concept of comparing, you know, watching a movie on even a high def screen in our apartments to the exquisite experience of going to a theater, they're not even comparable. And I think John even alluded to it, that everybody appreciates the difference between the two. You know, Cabin Fever is not going to disappear because of day-and-date release. Not wanting to watch a movie with your parents looking over your shoulder or not wanting to get out of the house to get away from the kids is not going to disappear. I think where John is making a mistake is he's actually downgrading the theatrical experience, that he's not giving it enough credit. And rather than saying, you know, really what I expected was he'd say, Mark, you're full of it, and we're going to prove it by showing just how great the theatrical experience is. And I think the theater industry really should make that effort to distinguish itself rather than to try to enforce walls around itself.
You're talking there about day and date release. That is putting it out on multiple DVD and cinema on the same
day.
Just giving
users a choice. You know, how many of us have been in a situation where we'd love to go see a movie, but we just can't get to the theater?
John Fithian, here's how Mark Cuban has come back ever since Bubble came out. He said, if theater owners can't figure out how to make going to the cinema special enough, different enough from watching at home, then they're just not making the most of what they've got in their hands. What do you say to that?
Well, we are making it special. First of all, going out of the home, I agree with Mark. People will continue to want to go to the cinema. It's a shared experience. It's a big screen. It's a special sound system.
It's a place to take your date.
Yeah, absolutely. You want to get out of the house. You want to leave your parents. You want to leave your kids. You want to have a fun time. We'll continue to improve that experience. This year, we're beginning a massive transition in the industry to go to digital technologies, to have high resolution, high quality pictures that have never been seen before in the cinema. So we want to take advantage of new technologies. Mark's also right that most of our patrons, in a world where movies were released everywhere at the same time, would continue to go to the cinema. The problem is that some wouldn't. Some percentage of people who currently go to the cinema, if they had DVDs available on the same day, would simply just be lazy and stay home. Our business has small enough profit margins that if a certain percentage stays home, it'll have a crippling impact on the cinema business. And here again, consumer choice would be reduced because people might not have that local cinema as a choice anymore under Mark Cuban's model.
Mark, I've got to challenge you on this super attractive theater principle. I mean, you know, I don't have any great media set up at home, you know, very, very ordinary. And yet, a lot of times when I go to cinemas these days, you know, the floor's sticky. People are talking because they're used to watching movies at home now. The popcorn's stale. The movie, the projection isn't that great. You know, they maybe don't even smell good. I mean, what's going to make theater so competitive with sitting at home with exactly what you want, with exactly the company you want around you? I mean, I know people like to watch.
You're actually making my point, Tom. I mean, the key to success are the theaters themselves. I mean, it doesn't.
But a lot of them stink.
Well, then that's a problem we have to fix. You know, you're going to stay home anyways, whether or not DVDs are available day or date. You know, a theater, just like the Dallas Mavericks, we always say we have to be the answer to what do you want to do tonight. And we say the same thing about the Landmark theaters for the demographics we shoot for. You know, we have to be the answer to what do you want to do tonight. I want to go to a Landmark theater because I trust their choice in movies. I trust that the experience is going to be great. I trust I'm going to be able to have a clean experience with a well-projected environment. And, you know, to John's point about digital cinema, Landmark is the first chain to have any, you know, real distribution of 4K digital projection screens. You know, when we released Bubble, the 20 Landmark showings were all digitally projected. We had the first Sony 4K, and because the movie was actually produced in high definition with the understanding it would be shown digitally, it was a phenomenal experience on the big screen. It was really a differentiated experience, and that's part of the production process in these movies we create.
Does digital really make a better experience if you're sitting in the theater?
Without question.
How so? What? It's what just looks better on the screen. Why?
Well, it depends on how it was produced. If it was produced digitally with the understanding it was going to be shown digitally, then you can make different creative choices, and that's exactly what Steven Soderbergh did with Bubble. But beyond that, you can also a patron will know that when they go see a movie that's been running for 2, 3, 4 weeks, and it's the 100th or 200th or 1,000th showing, it's going to look exactly as good as the very first screening on opening night, which is something you cannot assure with film, which tends to deteriorate over time.
John Fithian, what about it? Can the theater owners of America make that experience in the theater so seductive, so big screen, so far beyond what you can do at home, that people are going to come out in the numbers required to keep it healthy, to keep Hollywood turning out great films?
Oh, absolutely. And digital cinema is happening all across our business. It's not just Landmark. I applaud Mark for doing it. But most of our major members are doing deals to put digital cinema in right now.
So if they can make it that great, what's the problem? You said it's the biggest threat to the viability of the cinema industry today.
Yeah, John, what's the problem?
don't listen to me. Listen to Sumner Redstone, who's the chairman of Viacom, one of the biggest media companies in the world, who said any theater owner who agreed to play pictures day in, day with DVD would be committing suicide. Or listen to Howard Stringer, who's the head of Sony Corp, who said, if you collapse a window and go day and date, you eliminate the movie theater, you're doing movie of the week, and you've lost the sizzle of the pictures. So these people who run the biggest companies in the world, who own movie studios, who put movies into theaters, understand that the model that Mark's talking about just doesn't work in our business.
Well, let me create a scenario for you, John. I'm very curious. And you know, I respect John for standing up for his membership, and this is obviously nothing personal. You know, anybody who has young kids knows that when you take them to a movie, if there was a DVD of Shrek 2 available for sale while they were walking out of the theater, there's no way either your son or daughter would be lying on the floor kicking and screaming, or you would be buying a copy of the DVD.
They've got to have it.
They've got to have it. And given that you could sell that DVD for $29.95 and have $17 gross margin as opposed to $3 gross margin on that box office and $2.50 per cap on popcorn and soda, you stand to make a whole lot more money selling, let's just say, in the children's market. Why not do that?
John Fithian?
On a very special picture like Shrek, Mark, you're absolutely correct. The problem is, as the father of a three-year-old that I am, I know that on many pictures, if the option to watch TV at home when the movie first came out were available, a lot of parents would just stay home because they don't want to take their kids out to the cinema.
And there,
so
and
for some very special pictures, of course, people would still go to the cinema. But for many movies, people would stay home, and that would kill the cinema business.
Well, which is just to the point that the types of movies that are made will adjust, you know, so that they are movies that take advantage of the big screen. But at the same time, you know, there's also ways to incent people, you know, with Bubble and before that with Enron, we kicked back a percentage of the DVD sales to the theaters that showed Enron, which was nominated for an Academy Award and grossed more than, you know, $4 million at the box office. And we'll do the same thing with Bubble, and we'll do the same thing with all the future releases that we have planned. So there's an incremental economic incentive. We gave them copies of the DVDs to sell in the theaters, and they've sold very, very well. And so, you know, the independents that showed Bubble, a lot of – you know, there weren't a ton of people who showed up for the movie, but those who did, a lot of them bought the movies, which is the equivalent of you know, quadrupling the box office for them.
So maybe it works outside the box where Mark Cuban likes to play, but John Fithian is not so sure. John, thanks very much for being with us this hour.
You're welcome.
John Fithian, president of the National Association of Theater Owners. Mark Cuban is our guest. You can join us, 800-423-8255. Dan is calling from Boston. Hi, Dan, you're on the air.
Hi. Well, first of all, I'd just like to say I think Mark is a great role model for entrepreneurs. And I think the reason entrepreneurs are able to thrive and prosper is because we don't come from the tribal knowledge of the industry that we may want to participate in. So when you look at the larger companies, what really drives them are bureaucracy, mediocrity, you know, going along with the institutional thinking. And I think what drives entrepreneurs is a totally different set of objectives.
We got that. So he's rocking their world, Hollywood's, and maybe ours. But is Mark Cuban going to end up driving us down to movie of the week style productions? You know, no more Titanic, forget it. No more grandeur. It's going to be, I mean, maybe great, but small.
No such luck. Mark actually has the right idea. The real issue that the gentleman, John, I think, was talking about, I think is all about content. I have three kids, and I love going to the movies. I would go 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. I think the bigger issue for Hollywood is where are the great stories, where's the compelling artistry. Everything is about Friday the 13th and, you know, movies that really aren't resonating. And I think it's all about content. I think if you make great material, then I don't think it's an issue. I think if you look at the big blockbusters of this year, it's things like The Chronicles of Narnia, it's things like Harry Potter, it's things like Lord of the Rings, and all of the, quote, traditional movies are doing $30 million. So what that says to me is that's not a release problem of when do I put content out and how many different varieties. That's much more about how do I create content where the average movie is 100 to 200 million versus 30 to 50.
Dan, we've got it. There's a vote for compelling artistry and for our entrepreneur. Let me get a call from North Augusta, South Carolina. Wade is calling. Hi, Wade. You're on the air.
How you doing?
Great.
I guess my comment is, you know, from the artist perspective, too. I see a lot of the avenues of distribution kind of monopolized and isolated out of Hollywood, and I'm wondering is Mr. Cuban's method going to help artists as far as different distribution outlets?
Going to
no
help artists in what way? Let me just clarify, Wade. What do you mean exactly?
Every movie that's written is not designed to be a blockbuster. Some movies that are written are designed just for the crowd. I mean, every movie is supposed to make money. I'm not saying that, but I think that there's so many artists out here with so many good stories to be told that, you know, if it's not the blockbuster, you really don't get the kind of support from the different industries, the industry that's out there right now. And I'm wondering if his method is going to be able to help artists with different avenues of distribution.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And our actions speak, you know, louder than any words I could possibly say. If you look at our first day and date release, and it wasn't day and date to DVD, but it was on HDNet Movies and in theaters the same day, and that's Enron, The Smartest Guys in the Room by Alex Gibney. We made it for only $770,000, which is a pittance, you know, relative to Hollywood, yet it just won the Writers Guild of America Award for Best Documentary, and it's one of the nominees for an Oscar for Best Documentary. Bubble, I mean, that's artistry at its best. We have a program we've created created called trulyindie.com, where we're allowing people to come in and take advantage of our digital projection environment at Landmark. If you look at the movies that Landmark shows, you know, they're not the Hollywood blockbusters. And if you look at the movies that have been nominated for Oscars right now, with the exception of Munich and relative to some, you know, even Munich could be considered an art house film. But the Oscar nominees for Best Picture, including one we executive produced, Good Night and Good Luck, nobody wanted to make that movie. But Todd Wagner, myself, and Jeff Skoll stood up and said, this is a unique movie that needs to be made. And we'll continue to do that. We'll continue to open the doors. And actually, digital projection makes it easier by reducing the cost of distribution, which allows us to show more movies and different types of movies.
Don't have to ship all that celluloid around. You just made this big six-movie deal with Steven Soderbergh, kind of a legend for starting out indie, Sex, Lies, and Videotape, and Traffic, and Ocean's 11, and a lot more. What's coming down the pike in that half dozen films? That's a big deal.
I don't know. To be honest with you, I don't know. Part of what we try to do is to allow creative people to be creative. And we told Steven, just do what you do. And Bubble was the first example. And we've said the same thing with Alex Gibney. And he's doing a documentary about Hunter S. Thompson, among other things. We've got a whole slate of movies. If people want to check out what's on the horizon, you can go to hdnetfilms.com. We're distributing, not day and date because we didn't make this movie, but we have a movie coming out this weekend called The World's Fastest Indian with Anthony Hopkins, which is a family movie that was produced and developed by Anthony in New Zealand. That's not your typical movie, but we just love the content and we love the story. And, you know, I encourage people to check it out, but it's far from the Hollywood mainstream. Hollywood didn't want to touch it.
And what's got you so political all of a sudden? You're supposed to be Mr. Entertainment. We heard it in the way you described the Mavericks. Now you've got Enron, the smartest guys in the room, capturing the Freedmans, the war within.
I got crucified on.
They called you a jihadist propaganda producer. Why so political? What's taking you in that
direction? And we're looking at a movie about Jack Abramoff, too, a documentary.
Okay.
The movies that other people are afraid to make that can't be made through the Hollywood system, we have our eyes wide open to. And I think it's, you know, we're very
fortunate. Is it a profit issue or a political issue, a principle?
All the above. You know, if we can make a profit at it, and I think we will because of the day and date release strategy, and also because we're the only vertically integrated company that is small enough and quick enough on our feet to be able to do these things. I mean, we've got all the tools that you've mentioned. We've got distribution through Magnolia Pictures. We have a TV outlet with HDNet and HDNet Movies. We have Landmark Theaters, where our customer base expects us to look at movies that take chances.
Mark Cuban, you talk about something else. Let's get off in another direction here. The multi-tier internet. So you're tearing up Hollywood. You're going to tear up the internet as well? What for? Why?
On my blog, I just decided to take that on as a subject.
What is it?
Basically, there's a tendency in the internet to be open, to have an open source attitude, if you will, where, you know, anything that a big company, particularly a telco or network provider, might do is to change the way things are is perceived as negative. And Bell South came out, among others, and said, you know what, we're going to consider creating multiple tiers of internet service so that we can provide better service for certain types of applications. Mm. Unfortunately, you know, the way they presented it was, well, we're going to allow Google and Yahoo and, you know, Hollywood to stream their movies better, and people perceived that as being at the expense of traditional internet access. I looked at the situation and wrote that, you know, I didn't see it the same way. I thought that there are a lot of applications right now that would be very valuable to the general population, like medical applications, that are being priced out of their reach because you have to buy a private network application, or you have to have an IT department, or you have to buy leased lines.
You mean the ordinary internet's not good enough, reliable enough, fast enough to what? To send a picture of my gallbladder?
Well, no, let's just say, that's a simplistic example, but let's just say you have somebody who's an invalid and can't get out of the home, and you connect a digital video camera, and you want to be able to do two-way video conferencing with a doctor in a hospital somewhere who's a specialist in whatever that person's problems happen to be.
And you're saying let's stratify the web to do this so I'd get like maybe a free service or cheap if it was crummy web, and if I pay a premium, I'm going to get faster, higher quality web service?
Well, you can do it right now by paying a significant premium. I could go to and I could get a network integrator to set all that up and do it so it works perfectly, but it'd be extremely expensive and require a lot of expertise. What I was suggesting was that if the network operators, like the telcos, like the cable networks, created tiers, then the open source community could write applications that worked with that tiered service of provision, if you want to call it that.
If you can afford
enable,
it.
Well, it should be a lot less expensive because it doesn't require special applications like it happens right now.
So there it is. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I thought it opened the internet up more, and because you can take applications that traditionally have to be bandwidth hogs in order to try to work well, you actually could improve the performance for everybody else.
And I read you saying sooner or later something like this is going to have to happen when everybody starts downloading all this heavy material that the internet just won't be able to carry it.
Right, and a lot of people confuse that I was talking about the backbone of the internet, and I'm not. I'm talking about the last mile.
Mm-hmm.
What happens now is there are various points of time, whether it's your cable modem or DSL line, where things slow down. It's not always the same speed all day long, and we've experienced that. And the reason is because of the traffic in the last mile and other congestion points. And by tiering service, you can kind of put people on the fast lane, if you will, or the multi-occupancy lane, and really enable more bandwidth for traditional internet applications.
Things slow down, but I'm not sure Mark Cuban's brain does. We've got a lot of callers who want to talk with you. Ben's calling from Iowa City, Iowa. Hi, Ben. You're on the air.
Hey, Mr. Cuban, I just wanted to say thanks for teaching me so much about the NBA. I'm a big
thanks,
fan
Ben.
Of yours from that avenue. But another comment. Isn't your situation with film analogous to what's happening with like blogs and big media journalism?
Did you say blogs, Ben? Blogs and what, big newspapers?
Yeah, just how it seems like big newspapers' perceptions of other smaller entities talking about the news.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think that Mark's method seems to allow for other smaller creative types to get their content out there with this type of distribution.
Mark Cuban?
Yeah, there's no question about it. It's control versus risk. You know, it's the innovator's dilemma. Traditional media, whether it comes to dealing with blogs, really doesn't like the concept that maybe people look for authority outside of traditional media. And Hollywood's the same way. You heard John Fithian refer to it. The big media, the companies that own the big major studios, you know, Viacom with Sumner Redstone and Sir Howard Stringer with Sony, you know, they don't want to see things change because they are the gatekeepers. And, you know, a lot of what I'm talking about really will I hate to use the word disintermediate, but it really will create some instability with the gatekeepers.
We hear that. We're reading, you know, panic stirred among just about everybody involved in making, distributing, or showing. Mark Cuban doing it. But do you see, I mean, blogs have taken us off in all kinds of directions. Do you see movies becoming more diverse? I mean yours would suggest so already. Capturing the Freedmans, Enron, the smartest guys in the room, and the War Within, that's pretty diverse right out of the box.
Yeah, no kidding. And, you know, you're starting to see high-definition production tools really come down in price. It's not inconceivable to have a high-definition digital video editing on a laptop and putting it right out onto a digital projector, which, you know, just to that point, Steven Soderbergh shot Bubble in high definition, and before it ever touched film, which was at the last point in the process, we screened the final version at the Venice Film Festival on a digital projector from Texas Instruments, and even Steven was stunned at how great it looked, and the audience gave it a standing ovation.
Well, you can't argue with that. Kel's calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Hi, Kel, you're on the air.
Hi, I just think that cinema owners should be slapping this man on the back, thanking him. He's a hero. He's totally given them a wake-up call and an opportunity to do something about this industry that's really innovative, and I think he's a genius.
But what about John Fithian's concern that there's not going to be those big chunks of money floating around to bring you those big old-style Hollywood blockbusters? Do you want those? Do you believe that they won't be there, Kel? Will you miss them if they go away?
I think that they're there, and that'll be fine. It's up to cinemagoers to make that experience something positive. I go to Landmark Cinemas regularly, at least twice a month, and that is a different experience than most other cinema chains. And it can be done. This is a way to do it. They won't lose audience if they make it an experience that's worth, you know, paying $3 for a nickel's worth of popcorn.
And is it going to compete with your cozy media room at home once all those get cranked up and really, really nice, Kel?
I tell you, I bought Bubble last Saturday.
Thank you.
I would prefer to see it on a movie screen, but I also have a big DVD collection, you know? So it's like, it's a different experience, but it's not necessarily an experience that's not as enjoyable.
We got it. Kel, thanks for calling. Mark Cuban, where do you see the theater experience going? We read about the Dolby now, trying to get into the quality, not just of sound, but in the quality of the picture itself. You know, they were involved in 3D work. I look out 5-10 years. Is there going to be something so distinctive at the cinema that it's going to really compete with that beautiful media room at home once everybody tries to have one?
Yes, but there'll be pain along the way. And to John Fithian's point, I think there will be a reduction in the number of screens, just like there has been over the past 10 years. We saw there was a real bust in the movie theater industry maybe 8-10 years ago, and we won't see a bust, but we'll see a contraction. And that will allow the other screens really to have a little bit more business, give them the opportunity to reinvest in their theaters. So to Kale's point, when you go to the movies, it is a special experience, and they can afford to do digital projection, evolve to 3D projection, do things like allowing people to bring their iPod earbuds and plug it into the seat, or do it wirelessly.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe even take your iPod video and walk out and plug it in and receive the movie that way. There's going to be so many different digital opportunities that theaters can take advantage of, but they have to be willing to make those changes. Instead, the theater industry has been shooting itself in the foot. There's times when, you know, particularly in Los Angeles, in the early openings of movies, they'll check you to make sure you don't bring a cell phone in. I mean, why in the world would they want to, you know, because they're afraid of piracy, why in the world would they want to treat their customers as criminals in a declining industry?
They're afraid people are going to sit in their seat and record the movie right onto their cell phone video.
Right. Instead, people just won't go because they want to avoid the hassle. Mm. And I wouldn't go to a theater or screen that you know, patted me down to see, or made me check in my cell phone. That's ridiculous. I just don't want to be treated that way.
Do you hear the world changing? Let's take a turn, Mr. Sports Franchise Owner, from digital to sweat and effort on courts and fields. We've got
sure.
the Super Bowl coming up on Sunday. You're a Pittsburgh guy. You got the Steelers
yep.
in there. You've got
go Steelers.
Well, we hear that. You got the Mavericks in the middle of their season. Where do you see all this taking the very physical sort of grunt and sweat and push world of sports?
The cinema side or to applying to sports? Or
I mean, you're remaking entertainment. You're reimagining
right.
entertainment. Is it going to change what we actually see from – I mean, it already has in
yes.
many ways. But where are we
yeah.
going with athletes and the essence of sport as you start, you know, re-spooling the way it's shared with the world in new ways?
No question. You know, you make a great ask a great question, make some great points that the digital world is changing how every industry and no industry is, you know, is an anomaly to be excluded from it, including sports. You know, we use at the Dallas Mavericks, we take video of everything, and we track what happens in the video, and we aggregate statistics and correlate them back to the video so that we know, you know, we can track tendencies, whether it's players or officials. There's been scenarios where we've broadcast Dallas Mavericks games in high definition on digital cinema and in theaters. I don't see that as a big business, but, you know, if somebody wanted to see the Sunday Super Bowl on in high definition on a super huge screen, it wouldn't be inconceivable or necessarily a bad idea to get the rights to that and broadcast that in a theater. And I think more and more that's going to happen.
Ray's calling from Wall, New Jersey. Hi, Ray. You're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to comment on Mark's genius. I had one of those aha moments. I realized after 20 years in the computer services industry, he found the model. And the model simply is this. Come up with a concept that makes sense. Even though the technology isn't there yet, I know with Moore's Law, in 1, 2, and 3 generations at the most, I'll have a product developed. I'll be able to be ahead of everybody, and I'll be able to clean up. I'd like to know what he's working on now, not what.
Yeah, wouldn't we all lay it out there, Mark?
That's exactly the approach I take. High definition television is the perfect example. When everybody else was saying, "Oh, it's too expensive," I looked at a high def television and I saw a PC and I knew it was going to follow Moore's Law. and I knew the price points were going to come down and the experience was going to improve and the quality was going to get better. And, you know, you talk about where I look now for that. If you look at what's happening with hard drives versus DVDs and versus high-definition television, that's an area I'm actively exploring now. And to explain it a little bit more, the quality of pictures on a high-definition television is going to continue to improve. However, the standards for broadcast television have already been set. What you see on for the Super Bowl on ABC and high-definition television or on HDNet or CBS, whatever it may be, this Sunday, that's as good as it's going to get from a broadcast. So that creates opportunities to say, if we're creating a movie like Bubble in high definition, can we ever get to the point where we can show the uncompressed high definition, which is of a higher quality than what you see even in the cinema, and make that available for home or even theatrical use? And then you have to say, okay, well, how can I store that and how can I, you know, capture it? And that, then I look at the hard drives and say, hard drives are exploding in terms of storage, contracting in terms of price and size. And so there will be a point where we forget about whether it's Blu-ray or HD DVD and maybe even all optical media as a whole, and everything's either in hard drive storage or whatever happens to be the most economical large storage mechanism, and that's how we'll transport movies. And sorry for the long-winded answer.
Mark Cuban, we've just got half a minute left. You're the multi-billionaire. You're the tech guy. You could have turned in any direction. Why movies?
I love movies, and I love challenges, and when you mix movies and technology together, you know, I'm not the world's most creative guy, but I think I have a finger on the pulse of media. I have a finger on the pulse of technology. I have a finger on the pulse of what consumers like. And the challenge of trying to intertwine all those successfully is just exciting to me.
You're going to keep stomping at courtside? You're going to keep yelling and throwing the
towel? Oh, yeah, of course I am. I mean, you know, everybody's got some place where they relieve all their aggression, right? And my spot is on the sidelines of a Mavs game rooting on my team.
Well, we see it. And now we've got a lot better sense of the man behind the madcap antics there. We appreciate your sharing the time with us. Mark Cuban, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you. I really loved it. Thanks, Tom. Great job.
Media mogul, billionaire, media maverick, entrepreneur Mark Cuban. He joined us from Dallas. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.